Tomorrow is the first day of spring.
So?
So?
She insisted, irritated now.
Tomorrow I will be getting a task of my own.
You're 12 already?
Oliver gaped at her, running both hands through his hair.
I thought you were 9.
Alice chose to ignore that last bit. Instead, she said, What if I have to catch a dragon like Fenny Birdfinsk? Or if I'm sent to the stars like Selly Sodcrier? Or, oh, if I have to spend a year mending a cow with nothing but a silver penny?
Don't be ridiculous, Oliver said.
No one has ever had to mend a cow with a silver penny.
They'll let you use a gold nickel at the very least.
Oh, kick the cow, Oliver. It will be impossible for me to help you.
Right, he said, dragging a hand across his face.
Yes, right. Alice's hopes had been dashed. They fell into a neat pile beside her feet.
Unless, Oliver said suddenly.
She looked up.
Unless,
he said again, then hesitated.
Go on.
He looked at her out of the corner of his eye.
Unless you waive your surrender.
Alice gasped. Waiving her surrender was an option that had never been an option. Her surrender was a ticket to something new, a task that would set her life in motion. Every child in Farronwood grew up aching to be tasked, awaiting adventure and the thrill of a challenge. Alice had been dreaming of this day her entire life. Different though she may have looked, her heart was a Farronwood heart, and she had the right to her task just like everyone else. She'd clung to this all through kinder care and middle care and home teaching with mother, this hope, this truth that one day, no matter her differences, she would be just like everyone else in this small way. Losing it would break her heart, just as losing father had broken her heart.
Picnic sticks, she didn't know what to do.
Alice wandered toward town in a daze. She wasn't entirely sure why she was headed this way, but today had been a strange day and she couldn't face going home just yet. Still, she seldom traveled this far out because going into town was a painful treat. There was so much she wanted to explore and purchase, but with just one think in her pocket, Alice could only do so much. She ambled down familiar grassy lanes toward the stone-paved streets of town with none of her usual excitement. She kept tripping over roots and sleeping birds and had to pause occasionally to rest her head against a tree trunk. There was so much on her mind she hardly had room for things like balance and hand-eye coordination. Alice sighed and prepared to set off again, but then she heard a rustle of paper and soon spotted the culprit. The town newspaper caught in a tree, clutched in a fist of branches. She managed to tug the paper free, scanning the front page with little interest. Boiled potatoes were 5 finks a sackful. The town square would be under construction in preparation for the surrender. Please excuse the mess. Had anyone seen Mr. Percival's pygmy goat? Zainab Tincture was selling a lemon canoe for 15 tintons. Alice's eyes went wide at that last line. 15 tintons was more magic than she'd ever seen. She couldn't even imagine what she'd do with it all. Though that was nonsense, wasn't it? Of course she could. She'd use it all to find father. Not for the first time. Alice wished she was old enough to earn a few stoppics of her own and not have to rely on mother's unreliable ways. Alice tucked the newspaper under her arm. Farronwood never had much news to tell. Things were always predictably lovely. The most recent trouble their little town had encountered was losing a few pigs to a particularly strong gust of wind, but that was a few days ago. The worst thing that had ever happened in Farronwood was losing father, of course. That had been the strangest thing of all, because leaving Farronwood was something no one ever did. Not really. Alice had certainly never left Farronwood. None of the other children had either. Being tasked was the one great exception. It was an adventure on which every Farronwood citizen was expected to embark, but everyone always came home in the end. Besides, they were surrounded by sea on every side but one, and to get out to the great unknown they had to pass through Fennelskeen, which, as I mentioned earlier, no one ever visited for obvious reasons. I should note here that these reasons were not readily obvious to me, an outsider, but try as I might, I couldn't get anyone to explain why,
Exactly. They never visited the town of Fennelskine. I think the unexciting answer was that they found the town unbearably dull, but we may never know for certain. But the simple reason no one ever left Farrenwood for very long was that Farrenwood folk needed magic to survive. Father had been gone for more than 3 years, a length of time that was considered unsurvivable. The children of Farrenwood were taught, from the moment they could talk, that leaving for long would never do. Magic was what they ate and breathed. It was the essence of all they were. Their relationship with the land was entirely symbiotic. They lived peacefully among the plants and trees, and in return the land helped them thrive. The seed of magic inside all people of Farrenwood was nurtured and sustained by the land they tilled and harvested. Without that, they'd be lost. And this was the real problem, the real heart of the hurt, the truth that made Father's loss so much more painful, that there was no magic outside of Farrenwood. Certainly not anywhere anyone had heard of. There had been rumors, of course, of other distant magical lands, but they were always rumors, weren't there? Rumors bred of boredom and nonsense, born of recklessness, and everyone in Farrenwood knew better than to believe nonsense. Farrenwood didn't hold with nonsense. At least, Alice didn't think they did, but she was never really sure. Losing Father to the great unknown had made Alice a believer in all kinds of nonsense, and she didn't mind that it made her odd. Maybe Father had found a bit of magic elsewhere, and maybe he was holding on. Maybe, she thought, he was still trying to find his way home. Alice lived in a time before proper maps, before street signs and numbered homes. She lived in a time when leaving home meant saying goodbye and hoping you'd be able to find your way back. Hope, you see, was all she had, and she would hold on to it, come hills or high water. The center of town was always a bit of a shock for Alice, no matter how many times she'd wandered through, and I can't say I blame the girl. It was a bit of a shock at first glance. The endless sequence of bold buildings appeared to be shoved together in what was apparently a fine show of geometry well studied. Curves shook up and into straight lines, tops capped by triangle or dome or dollop of roof, depending on the storefront, while walls were textured by octagonal, triangular, and star-like tilework. Chimneys were spirals of brick charging into the sky. Doors were tall as walls and nearly as wide, and, as you might have already imagined, colors were sharp and bright and endless. Indeed, one might occasionally be pressed to wonder whether the aesthetic of Farrenwood wasn't a direct answer to the question, how many colors might we fit in one place? It was a string of streets woven together in no particular fashion and for no particular reason other than to accommodate the buildings that appeared to have sprouted straight from the ground. Alice's family was one of the very few that lived so far from town, and though it was sometimes hard to be high up in the hills and far from the heart of things, she was also seldom bothered with the business of seeing old schoolmates or nosy grown-ups who thrived on the buzz and babble of crowds. For the most part, Alice relished her occasional ambles into the middle of the middle, but though she was eager for a peek at the excitement, she was always swiftly reminded of her place within it. Alice stood at the very edge of it all and let herself be swallowed up by the sounds and scents of city life. Rain light ensured that the day was warm and the flowers fresh, and bells rang out while friends called to one another. Fathers clasped hands with mothers who called for children to please be still, while shopkeepers stood on stoops and waved their wares. Alice felt the weight of the single fink in her pocket as she stared and wished, as always, that Father were there to hold her hand, but no matter. Alice held her own hand, one clenched tightly in the other, and pushed her way through the throng. She wasn't tall enough to see very far ahead, but she was certainly short enough to be knocked into by strangers and occasionally snapped in the cheek by a wind-blown skirt. The air had been tousled by the hands of careful spice-keepers, and Alice tasted mint silk and snips of coconut, and nearly everything she touched left her smelling like saffron. A gaggle of children had crowded around Asal, Masal, and Chai, eagerly testing samples of a tea that guaranteed they'd grow a full inch by morning. Teenagers were digging through ornate tubs of temporary enchantments. 5 finks to fall in love, 7 finks to grow your hair, a stoppick to disappear. while the older crowd was found relaxing at a series of tables and chairs pressed with intricate patterns of colorful glass. The ladies and gentlemen old enough to indulge puffed on curlicued gold pipes and smiled, blue and red and purple smoke escaping their lips as they laughed. Alice snuck a sniff as she tiptoed past and felt her head go sideways with the weight of it. She smiled despite herself and, not for the first time, found herself wishing she were old enough to do more interesting things. Alice pressed forward, determined toward Shirini Farini, the absolute best sweet shop in town. She scrambled up her gentle mountains of hand-woven rugs, each dense with color and detail. She slowed only to stare in awe at a stall stacked with warm, freshly baked discs of bread, all golden brown and haphazardly kneaded. Poor Alice was so distracted by the aroma of baked goods, she nearly collided with a crowd of men singing in the street. She managed to dart away just in time to avoid the sight of Daniel Rubin, who'd been crossing the road to join the crooners. Alice fought back a scowl. Oh, there was always someone to be envied, wasn't there? For Alice of little color, Daniel Rubin was a nightmare. He was the most radiant 12-year-old she knew, with his rich black hair and ink-like eyes. His skin was the color of dusk, auburn and magenta and cinnamon all at once. He had color and he wore it well, framing his already luminous eyes in kohl that served only to make Alice feel worse. She'd heard the whispers. She knew the rumors. The town was betting on Daniel to win the surrender this year because someone so colorful was undoubtedly the most magical. In the hearts of Ferenwood folk, Alice didn't stand a chance. But she would prove them wrong. Alice clenched her fists and pushed forward through the crowd with such force that she nearly knocked into a group of girls tinting their nails with henna. For just a moment, Alice froze, overcome by a great longing to join them, but quickly shook it off, keeping her head down as she passed, ever mindful of the limitations of her pocket. When she finally reached Shirini Farini, Alice was out of breath and exhausted. Coming into town was always a trek, but she should have known better than to have ventured out today on the eve of the surrender. All of Ferenwood was out to celebrate, and the festivities would likely last all week. Alice checked the sun as she stepped inside the store and noted she had very little time to get home before dark. The moment she stepped over the threshold, Alice was overpowered by a heady perfume of sugar. By second three, she was in a happy daze, her every thought sweeter, her very heart lighter, and her hands happily grabbing for everything in sight. Alice knew better than to let the sugar dust get the better of her, but she was happy to rest for just a moment longer before she found the strength to fight again. As soon as she shook off the daze, she found herself sifting through candies with a more stable mind. One Fink wouldn't afford her many options, but she liked to look around all the same. Glass apples were hung from the ceiling, honey canes gift-wrapped in packs of three. Fig cherry jams were stacked in windows, and honeysuckle taffies were spilling out of wooden barrels stacked in each corner. There were walls of iced plums and pomegranates, bushels of baskets weighed down by gold chocolate leaves, and tens of jars of apricot honey that fizzed in your mouth. Alice looked and looked and never tired of the splendor, but she very nearly gasped herself silly when she saw the trays of zulzuls. A zulzul was a spiral of fried dough soaked in honey and covered in sugared rose petals, and on any given day Alice would tell you that zulzuls were her favorite pastry. Note that this confession would be entirely ridiculous, as Alice had never tasted a zulzul in her life, but she could imagine herself loving zulzuls, and somehow that was enough. Finally, reluctantly, Alice selected a single dilly pop from a small plastic bin and promised herself that one day, some day, she would return with a pocketful of Finks and choose as many sweets as she liked. One day. Her single task now accomplished, Alice was in a hurry to get home. There was very little light left, and if Alice was late one more time, she didn't know what Mother would do. She hurried down sidewalks and tore through spice stalls and slipped between racks of skirts. She spun around shopkeepers and nearly tripped passers-by and only glanced up once or thrice to sneak looks at her most favorite storefronts as she rushed home. Knot and Tug was selling self-sewing needles for only 3 finks apiece, and Alice tucked the information away. Sobsy, the local grocer, was selling lemon blossom twists, 2 finks a pound, and Alice took note for Mother. But the Danger and the Granger, the best bookshop in town, had new books on display in the window, and Alice was thrown off course. She stopped so suddenly she nearly fell over, and, despite her better judgment, she snuck closer to press her nose against the glass. Once near enough to the window, the first thing Alice noticed was a small crowd of people buzzing animatedly around a man sporting a very trim beard. He wore several spectacles and an oversized tunic, and Alice realized then that he was an author, ostensibly there for a reading of his book. She squinted to scan the title of the tome in his hands. The Birth of the Stoppick, Inside the Mind of Fenjoon Hartweather and Salda Millerdon, the Greatest Harvesters of Magic in Ferenwood History, and sighed, disappointed. Alice didn't much care for the history of harvesting. She found the business terribly boring, and, if she were being honest, she might even tell you she resented the whole of it simply because she feared it would be her fate one day. Alice had worried all her young life that she'd end up good for nothing but tilling the fields. Tilling was honorable, but it was an exceptionally unglamorous job, and Alice preferred to be on the other side of things, taking raw magic and transforming it into usable matter. Anyhow, she was about to push on when she remembered the very reason she'd stopped. There were 2 books on display in the shop window. The Surrender, The Task, and The Long Way Back. How to Cope When Your Child Leaves Home. And just beside it, Champions of Recent Past, Remembering Our Ferenwood Heroes. Alice's eyes nearly split in 4 as she shoved herself through the shop doors and ran for the books in the window. Limbs trembling, heart racing, Alice picked up a copy of Champions of Recent Past and ran her hand over the cover. There, with a small selection of other town heroes, was a picture of Father, aged 12 and glorious, the winner of his own surrender just 30 years prior. Alice had always known Father was a champion. Father won the title for his dexterity of mind and for his ability to retain and recreate images at will. His task was to travel the land and work with the town elders to become the first true cartographer of Ferenwood. He and the elders had been working together to create maps so precise and so easily navigable that one day all Ferenwood residents would have a copy of their own, enabling them to travel from one neighbor hill to another without complication or confusion. In fact, his work had been so remarkable that he'd been asked to stay on with the town elders ever after. This kind of treatment was fairly customary for champions, who were considered the single most talented citizens of their year. But Father had been more than just a champion. Father was a friend to Ferenwood. He was loved by all. In fact, it was often whispered that one day Father would be named a town elder, too. Instead, Father had left, and not a soul knew why. Mother was making tea when Alice finally made it home, just before dark. Alice pushed open the front door with a secret weighing down her skirts. Inside her pocket was the 1 dilly pop, carefully wrapped, to be saved for a special occasion. Alice would have to wait weeks to get her hands on another fink, but she'd made peace with the loss of the last of her money. The triplets were eating appleberry jam straight from the jar, small purple fingers sticking to their faces. Mother was humming a tune as she moved about the kitchen, and even though Alice stood before her, Mother wiped her just-washed hands on her apron and didn't seem to notice her daughter at all. Oh, it didn't matter. Alice was tired. She was torn, and she took a seat, dropping her chin in her hands. What a day today had been. Nothing would shake the weight of the world from her shoulders tonight, not even a cheekful of candy. Alice wished the world would shed a few pounds. She desperately wanted to find Father, but she also desperately wanted to have a task, and so she'd come to no conclusion at all, leaving Oliver in a twist of his own. Finding Father meant trusting Oliver. It meant sacrificing her own future to help him with his, and even then there was no guarantee of anything. Besides, just because she could see through a lie did not mean she had any reason to trust Oliver Newbanks. Alice pushed away from the table and slipped into her bedroom, grateful for the chance to be alone while her brothers were busy in the kitchen. There was one small section of this room that was hers and hers alone, and it was hidden under the floorboards. Alice had hidden her life underneath this room, books and trinkets, clothes and flowers, the only precious things she owned. She carefully removed a few planks of wood and unearthed her outfit for tomorrow. She'd been working on it for 2 years, carefully stitching it together piece by piece. 4 skirts, a half-sleeved blouse, a vest, and a cropped sleeveless jacket, all to be worn together. The final bit was the headpiece, crocheted by hand, trimmed with a train of yellow tulle and strung with hammered tin coins. Alice had spent months dyeing the fabrics and adorning the plain cloth, embroidering flowers, sewing beads and sequins into intricate patterns, and adding tiny mirrors to the hem to make the skirt glitter with every step. It was an explosion of colors, heavy with the weight of all the work she'd done. She even knew exactly which flower she'd weave into her braid. Alice knew she would be incredible. She would so thoroughly impress the town elders that they'd have no choice but to give her the best task, the grandest task. She'd go on to be a town hero, just like Father, and she would make her family proud. She'd had it all figured out. Children in Farronwood prepared their whole lives for their surrender. Each child was born with a singular magical talent, and it was the job of parents and teachers to recognize and nurture that talent and ultimately develop their surrender performance. The performance was crucial because it was a presentation of untapped potential. It was critical to show just how useful your magical talent could be, because the best talents would go on to receive the best tasks, the best adventures. This was what Alice had dreamed of. But Alice hadn't needed any of that extra help because she'd figured it out on her own. Father had told her many moons ago what she needed to do. Maybe he hadn't realized it then, but she had. "Do you hear that?" he asked her one night. They were standing under the night sky.
"Hear what?"
Alice asked.
"The music."
"Which music?"
Father closed his eyes and smiled at the moon.
"Oh, Alice," he whispered, "unfold your heart, sharpen your ears, and never say no to the world when it asks you to dance."
They slept in the grass that night, she and Father, not saying another word. Alice listened to the earth come alive, the wind singing, the grass swaying, the lakes swimming laps. Trees stretched their branches, flowers yawned themselves to sleep, the stars blinking fast as they dozed off. She witnessed it all, listening closely the whole time. She had never felt more real in all her life. And every night after that, when Father asked her if she could hear the music, Alice knew exactly what he meant. And when the world asked her to dance, she never said no. Alice looked up and found Mother standing in the doorway. Mother didn't look upset, but she had her arms crossed against her chest all the same. She nodded to the skirts Alice was holding in her lap.
"Are you ready?" Mother asked.
"I think so,"
Alice said quietly, wondering what Mother would say if she knew how selfish her daughter was, selfish enough to consider getting tasked over finding Father. Mother would never forgive her.
"What if I have to leave Farronwood?"
Alice said, feeling unexpectedly emotional.
"Will you be all right without me? How will you get by?"
"Oh, we'll find a way to manage,"
Mother said, staring at her hands as she smoothed out her apron.
"I've been stowing away the berries for some time now."
Alice wondered whether Mother would ever realize how deeply those words hurt her that night. Mother had answered a question Alice did not ask. Alice wanted Mother to tell her she'd be missed, that she'd be sorry to see her go. Alice wasn't asking about the Farronberries at all. It was only then that Alice saw how little Mother needed her. Alice did not belong in this small home where no room was her own, where her few possessions had to be buried beneath it. She knew now that no one would miss her so long as Mother had her medicine berries, and it made her feel terribly lonely. Father had already left her, and now, in her own way, Mother had too. Alice was on her own, and she knew then, in that moment, that no matter what happened, she would forever regret a decision to waive her surrender. She would never forgive herself for not forging a path of her own. So, it was decided. She would dance tomorrow. And Oliver Newbanks could step on a porcupine. Alice would find Father by herself. I haven't any idea how many chapters are in this book. The morning arrived the way Alice imagined a whisper would, in tendrils of gray and threads of gold, quietly, quietly. The sky was illuminated with great care and deliberation, and she leaned back to watch it bloom. Alice was sitting atop a very high hill, the whole of Ferenwood snoozing just below. Sleeping homes exhaled quietly, smoking chimneys gently puffing, unlit windows glinting golden in the dawn. Dew had touched the earth, and the earth touched back. Blades of grass shivered awake as they reached for the sky, freshly showered and slightly damp. Bees were lounging, bread was baking, birds were chirping to the trees. Everything smelled like warm velvet tea and a freshly scrubbed face and something very, very sweet. Alice smiled, clutching her arms in the breeze. The air was cold in places, but warm where the sun touched it, so she shifted to catch a spotlight. Her skirts glimmered in the glow as she adjusted her legs, and feeling a slight quiver in her stomach, Alice plucked a nearby dandelion and popped it in her mouth. This was it. Today she would be competing with every 12-year-old in the village. All 86 of them would stand before the town elders and surrender their greatest talents. In exchange, they hoped to be recognized and set with a task that would change history. In truth, simply being tasked at all was a great accomplishment. Ferenwood never talked of the children who were rejected outright, dismissed on account of being so thoroughly incapable that they could not possibly live up to a challenge. Instead, the conversation was always about the greatest task and which child it would go to. This auspicious day was a grand celebration of magic, and for Alice, who desperately longed to be more than nothing, the surrender meant everything. It meant redemption. Alice stood up and smoothed the creases in her skirts. She was so proud of this outfit and all the work she'd put into it. In fact, it was the only time she was happy to be wearing clothes. Not that there was anyone around to see them. She'd slipped out of the house while Mother and the triplets were still fast asleep. No hellos, no goodbyes, just Alice moving into a new moment. This quiet morning might have been her last for a long time, and she wanted it all to herself. Happy birthday to me, she thought. Alice was now officially 12 years old. She skipped a ways down the path toward the town square, skirts bunched in her hands, bangled ankles and wrists making a merry tune of their own. The path to the square was one of her favorites. Green stood sentinel on both sides of her. Celery trees and apple bushes and lime stalks, all as tall as she, swaying to a rhythm she recognized. The dirt was soft and welcome under her bare feet, and when it felt right she stopped, digging her toes into the ground as she turned her face up to the sky. Alice could see the entire square from here, and the sight of it stopped her still, the way it always did. Ferenwood had many tall trees, but only a few tall places, and the square was the tallest place in town, and even though the trees, ink trees and night trees, sink trees and climb trees, berry trees and nut trees and red trees and wild trees were rich in color, corn-colored and raspberry-stained and even a deep dark blue, and extremely varied, some grew pink stones and others dripped orange in the night. The square was tall and colorful and varied in ways the trees were not. The buildings in town seemed, understandably,
magicked together, strokes of a paintbrush licking them into being. Swirls and swirls of color had been swept together by a careful artist. Colors melted up walls and rushed down doors, orange and lavender swirling into a plump onion of a roof that sat snugly upon a structure painted gold. This was the health house. Green and yellow tangled with sapphire and silver to create a colorful dollop of a dome atop the schoolhouse. Strokes of flaming blue and rosy white were slicked together like an upside-down ice cream cone. This, the roof of the mint-colored courthouse. In this light, Fernwood looked delicious. Alice closed her eyes and drew in a deep breath. Father had taught her to love this town, and she couldn't help but want to make her people proud. The sky was in fine form this morning, ready for its big moment. The clouds would burst open just as soon as the ceremony was over, showering the village in felicitations from the sky. Rain meant renewal, and the people of Fernwood welcomed it. It was what their souls were made of. When their world was built, it was so breathtakingly beautiful, so rich and colorful. The sky wept for 100 years. Tears of great joy and grief flooded the earth, fissuring it apart and, in the process, creating rivers and lakes and oceans that still exist today. There was joy for the beauty, but great sadness, too. Sadness that no one was around to appreciate the majesty of it all. And so, as the story goes, Fernwood folk were born from the tears that watered the earth and grew them into being. The surrender was how they gave thanks. At 12, they surrendered themselves and their gifts and, in return, took on a task, the purpose of which was always to help someone or some place in need. They gave back to the world, and in the process, they grew up. This was when their lives truly began.
I hadn't wanted to mention this earlier, but Oliver Newbanks had been standing just to the left of our Alice for over 14 minutes before he finally stepped forward and pulled on her braid. I also feel compelled to mention that Alice responded by pinching him very, very hard. Oliver yelped and teetered, nearly losing his balance. He tugged up his shirt to inspect the damage and offered Alice a ripe word or two to express his feelings on the matter. Alice turned away, very purposely avoiding the sight of his bare torso and the sound of his still-babbling voice. "Would you hush?" she finally said to him. "You are ruining a perfectly good moment." She nodded to the sun inching its way up the sky. "Alice," he said impatiently, "you need to give me an answer. You promised you'd let me know before the surrender this morning, and now the moment is nearly upon us." Alice squinted into the distance, still avoiding eye contact with him. She wasn't sure why she cared, but for just a second, a very tiny part of her was almost sorry to disappoint him. She pushed it away.
"I'm afraid I cannot help you," she said quietly. "This day is too important, Oliver. I know Father would understand my decision."
Oliver seemed genuinely surprised. In fact, his wide eyes and high brows and open mouth came together to express their collective shock, all without saying a word.
"You can't be serious," he whispered.
"Alice, please, you can't really be serious."
"Quite serious, I'm afraid."
"But your father—"
"I will find him on my own. Don't you worry about him."
"But I already know where he is,"
Oliver nearly shouted. "I could get to him right now if I wanted to." Alice shot him a dirty look.
"Then why don't you?"
Oliver gaped.
"You are a rotten person," she said, "that you would dangle my father in front of me as though he were a bit of candy. It's not enough for you to simply bring him back to his family with no expectation of anything in return.
Hey, now."
"We have no deal, Oliver."
She cut him off.
"If you have even half a heart, you may tell me where my father is. Otherwise, I have a life to attend to."
"You are unbelievable," he sputtered.
"Good day, Oliver Newbanks, and good luck with your task."
And with that, she ran down the hill toward the village square. Oliver Newbanks was close behind. Alice's stomach felt stuffed with twigs, each nervous tap of her toes snapping one in half. The morning was brisk and buttery and sent a sudden shiver down her spine. She was standing in line with her peers, keeping very much to herself. Some were dressed in costume, others in plain clothes. Some looked nervous, others looked pompous. There was no way of knowing what any of it meant. The 12-year-olds had already signed in and each been assigned a number. Now all that was left to do was wait, and it was proving nearly impossible. Alice had the sudden, unfortunate need to make use of the ladies' toilets, and though she tried, she could not mute the din of voices around her. The people of Farronwood were dressed in their Farronwood finest. Gowns made of spider silk and hats carved from cottonwood, colors clashing and sounds smashing and cheers erupting for no reason at all. The audience was beginning to take their seats, wide-eyed and excited with the smell of spring fresh in the air. The stage looked lovely every year, but this year it looked especially fantastic. Today it was made to look just like a stretch of ocean, the plum-blue water lapping at the feet of its contestants and cascading to the ground. Just below it was an expanse of green, set with a smattering of tables and chairs carved from the arms and legs of fallen trees. Vines had knitted themselves across the backs of every chair, and the tables were set with gold baskets of glass apples and honey canes and chocolate-covered sizzle sticks and pitchers of fire cider and candied ice. An orchestra readied their instruments. The sky thundered in appreciation. Flowers were blossoming in hundreds of glass orbs suspended in midair, and the sun set fire to the sky, streaking the backdrop with an explosion of blush and tangerine and honey blue. It was all rather breathtaking. Quite. Whoever's job it was to decorate had put a little too much sugar in the air, and it was making Alice want to sneeze. She tried to stifle the impulse and coughed instead, startling the girl standing just to the left of her. Alice rocked back and forth on her heels and clasped her hands, smiling a shaky smile as the girl glanced her way. The girl smiled back and seemed to regret it. Alice stared down at her feet. Of the 86 of them, Alice was fourth in line, and she would be lying if she said she hadn't felt like upending the contents of her stomach just a little bit. Alice spotted Mother and the triplets as they searched for their seats, and she couldn't help but feel a spot of warmth settle inside her, soothing her nerves. She had hoped they would come, but really she wasn't sure. She never could be certain with Mother, if only because Mother had proven herself to be rather fickle these past few years. But despite their strange and often uncomfortable relationship, Alice couldn't help but want to make her mother proud. She'd hoped to make her proud today. In fact, the bitterness Alice felt toward Mother was just about to be forgotten until she saw Mother take a seat next to the Newbankses. Oliver caught her eye and glared. Alice glared back, as Mother laughed and shook hands and shared fruit with the family of the boy who'd been so cruel to her. Mother didn't seem to spare a single thought for her feelings. Alice didn't want to think about it then, but the truth was staring her straight in the face, and she could no longer deny it. Mother never seemed to be on her side. Alice hung her head and drew in a deep breath, determined to keep moving no matter what. One day, she said to herself, she would return home with Father in hand, and Mother would finally appreciate her. Just then came the sound of trumpets and a sudden explosion of color that fell and hung neatly in the sky. It was the official announcement, the beginning of the rest of her life. Mr. Lottingale stepped onto the stage. A hush fell over the crowd, and the 86 of them, hovering just to the side, were so collectively nervous Alice could almost hear their hearts racing in unison. Mr. Lottingale was one of the town elders, and he had come to make a speech. It was the obvious thing to do, to make a speech before the main event, but Alice could never take Mr. Lottingale seriously. He looked a bit like a pistachio. He was round and beige, cracked open only at the top, his head turtling out and his brown-green hair flopped around in the breeze. She knew it wasn't fair of her to focus only on Mr. Lottingale's looks, as he was certainly a nice enough person, but every time she looked at him, she couldn't help but think of the time she saw him lick a caterpillar off his upper lip. "Friends of Farronwood," he boomed, caterpillar voice creeping out of his caterpillar lips, "I congratulate you all on the first day of spring." The crowd cheered and stomped and raised their glasses of cider.
"Today is a most auspicious occasion," Lottingale went on, "and on, and on."
He spent the next 10 minutes giving a speech about the great day that is the day of their surrender, and I can't be bothered to remember it all. It went on for 9 minutes too long, if you ask me. But suffice it to say that it was a heartwarming speech that excited the crowd and sent jitters up Alice's skirts. And anyway, I hope you don't mind, but I'd like to skip ahead to the part where things actually happen.
They would all perform, all 86 of them. Only after all of the 12-year-olds had surrendered their gifts would they be allowed to take seats with their families, where they'd attempt to eat a meal while the elders took a break to deliberate. Once the decisions were final, an envelope would appear on their plates, their tasks carefully tucked inside. Of the group, only one task would be announced to all of Ferronwood. Only one child would be celebrated. Only the best. Alice held tight to this reminder as she watched Valentina Millie take the stage. She was the first of them, and Alice admired her for it. Valentina stood in the middle of the square with a great, quiet sort of dignity, never once letting it show that she'd been crying in the bushes just a moment before. And then she sang. She had the voice of a feather lily, effortlessly charming the lot of them. Valentina sang a song Alice had never heard before, and the words wrapped around their bodies, sending shivers up tree trunks and hushing the birds into a stillness Alice had never seen. The song was so lovely that Alice was blinking back tears by the end of it, certain that something strange and frightening was coming to life inside of her. Alice knew then that Valentina Millie had no ordinary voice, and though Alice was terribly jealous, her hands found themselves clapping for her competitor all the same. Next came Haider Zanotti, a boy with the bluest hair Alice had ever seen. Electric, violent blue, thick and rich and so gorgeous she was sorely tempted to run her hands through it. Haider stepped into the very center of the square, took a bow, and then jumped. Up. High. Straight into the sky. His hands caught something Alice could not see, and he was suspended in midair, fists clenched around what seemed to be an invisible ladder. He hoisted himself up and climbed until he was standing taller than the tallest trees, a speck in the distance held up by nothing at all. The crowd gasped, and some got to their feet, shielding their eyes against the sun as they tried to get a better look at where he'd gone. Then Haider jumped. He fell fast toward the ground, and a few people screamed, but Haider was prepared. He held both arms out as he came down, and, with just a few feet to fall, latched onto the air, his fists curling around some impossible bit of sky. He hung there for just a moment longer before dropping to one knee. When he finally stood up, Ferronwood had too. They were so excited and so impressed that Mr. Lottingale had to beg them to stop cheering so the proceedings could move forward. Haider rejoined the line, looking very pleased with himself. Alice knew she should have been happy for him, but she felt the knot in her stomach tighten, and so she bit her lip, hugging herself against the sudden chill creeping down her neck. Olympia Chu was up next. Olympia was a big girl, tall and rotund, her hair pulled back so severely she looked much older than 12. She walked onto the stage with not an ounce of nonsense about her, and when she looked out over the crowd, they seemed almost afraid to look back. Olympia clapped, and everything broke. Chairs, tables, glasses, pitchers, plates, and even one poor man's trousers, everything came crashing to the floor, and the citizens of Ferronwood with it. But just as they were about to start shouting out in disapproval, Olympia whistled, and all wrongs righted themselves. The tables repaired, chairs reupholstered, glasses pieced back together, and torn trousers were suddenly good as new. Alice looked down at herself. A loose thread in her skirts had sewn itself back into place. A smudge on her knee wiped away. Even her braid was suddenly smooth, not a single hair out of place. Alice couldn't help but be astounded. Olympia was just about to clap again when the crowd shouted, "No!" and ducked down in fear. Mr. Lottingale ran up to shuffle Olympia off stage. That meant Alice was next, and oh, she was terrified.
Only three others had gone before her, and already Alice knew she had made a great mistake. No one had been around to prepare her for today, not Mother, who didn't seem to care at all, and not the teacher she no longer had. Alice thought Father had given her this gift before he left, instilling in her this need to dance. She thought it was her talent, the gift she would surrender. Alice was only now realizing that this was a true talent show, and she, well, she was no talent at all. She could not sing Awake the Soul, could not climb air, could not right every wrong. She could only offer a dance, and she knew then that it would not be enough. Alice wanted to cry. But no, that wouldn't do. Mr. Lottingale was calling her name, and it was too late to give up now. Too late to tell Oliver she'd made a mistake, that she should have chosen Father over this moment of humiliation. Suddenly Alice was sorry. She was standing on stage, all alone, staring out at some 10,000 faces, and she could not make herself look at Mother. So she closed her eyes. The music found her the way it always did, and she let herself lean into it. She met the rhythm in her bones and moved the way she had 100 times before. Alice danced the way she breathed, instinctually. It was an inbuilt reflex, something her body needed in order to survive. Her arms and legs knew the rules, knew how to bend and twist and dip and switch. She spun and twirled, hips swaying, moving to a melody only she could hear. The moves came faster, quicker, more elegant and grand. Her feet pounded against the earth, drumming the ground into a clamor that roared through her. Alice's arms were above her now, bangled arms cheering her on, and she threw her head back, face up to the sky. Faster, faster, elbows unlocking, knees bending, bangles raining music down her neck. She moved like she'd never moved before, soft and slow, sharp and fast, heels hitting and ankles flicking and fingers swimming through the air. Her skirts were a blur of color, her whole body seized by a need to know the elements. And when she was finally done, she fell to the floor, head bowed, hands folded in her lap, skirts billowing out around her. Alice was a fallen flower, and she hoped she looked beautiful. She slowly lifted her head. The audience was looking on, only politely engaged, still waiting for her to finish, still waiting for her talent. Alice got to her feet and felt the sun explode in her cheeks.
"Are you quite finished, dear?"
This from Mr. Lottingale. She nodded.
"Ah,"
he said, his slack jaw quickly firming into a smile.
"Of course. Please rejoin the line, Miss Queen's Meadow."
There was a halted smattering of applause, the guests looking around at one another for a cue on how to react. Alice swallowed hard against the lump in her throat and walked back to her place in line, staring firmly at her feet and hardly daring to breathe. 82 others performed after she did, and Alice wouldn't remember any of them. There were a great many talents on display that day, and hers, as it turned out, was the strength to keep from bursting into tears in front of everyone. Alice could not make herself sit with Mother. After the ceremony, she found a quiet branch in a very tall tree and tried desperately to stay calm. She was inhaling and exhaling in tiny gasps, and she scolded herself for it, rationalizing all the reasons why she was being ridiculous. Surely, she considered, she was just being hard on herself. She was intimidated by her peers. This was normal. Besides, she'd not expected such great talent, so she was taken by surprise. And anyway, everyone was probably feeling the same insecurity she was. Most importantly, she hadn't been paying attention to the other performances. Certainly someone else could have done worse. This went on for a while. Alice pulled her knees up to her chest and hugged them tight. She would not cry, she'd decided.
There was no need. So maybe... probably. Well, definitely. She wouldn't get the best task. That was okay. Perhaps if her hopes hadn't been so high, her disappointment wouldn't have been so great, but she would learn from this and be better for it, and whichever task she did get would be just fine. She'd be grateful for it. Maybe it wouldn't be a coveted task. Maybe she wouldn't even get to leave Theronwood, but still it would be a task, and she would be happy to finally have a purpose. It would be the start of something new. It would be okay. She'd finally calmed her nerves long enough to make it down the tree. There she stood, half collapsed against the trunk, and promised herself over and over again that everything would be okay. She had done her best, and she couldn't have asked for more of herself. She had done her best. Finally, the elders reappeared. They were all smiling. A good sign. And this gave Alice great hope. Her shoulders sagged in relief, and she managed to peek out from behind the tree. Mr. Lottingale was the first of the 10 town elders to speak, and each of them took a moment to say something encouraging and inspiring. They spoke with such sincerity that for a minute Alice felt silly for having reacted as she did. They were looking out at the crowd with great pride. Surely she'd done better than she thought. She inched forward a bit more, no longer hidden from view. But just as Alice was considering joining Mother's table, the atmosphere changed. A trumpet blared, and there was glitter in the air, and thick, shimmery, plum-colored envelopes appeared on breakfast plates before her peers. The excitement was palpable. Everyone knew that an envelope contained a card of a specific color. Each color represented a different score. There were 5 categories altogether, and Alice had them memorized for as long as she could count. Score 5, green, spectacularly done. Score 4, blue, a very fine job. Score 3, red, perfectly adequate. Score 2, yellow, good enough. Score 1, white, rather unfortunate. Children were tearing their envelopes open, some with great confidence, others with great trepidation, while Alice was still straining to see if anything had arrived for her at Mother's table. It had indeed. Alice's heart would not sit still. She couldn't read Mother's face from here, but she could see Mother holding the envelope in her hand like she wasn't quite sure what to do with it. And though she looked around the square just once, Mother didn't seem to mind that Alice wasn't around to pick it up. Mother often said that she could never be bothered to understand why Alice did the things she did, and now, more than ever, Alice thought never being bothered was a very lazy way to love someone. Oliver's back was to her, so Alice couldn't see his face, but Mother was smiling at him, so he must have been speaking. He was likely using his gift of persuasion to ruin her life. Sure enough. After only a few seconds, Mother handed him her envelope, just handed it over. Her entire life folded into a piece of paper, and Mother just gave it away to a boy Alice wanted to kick in the teeth. Alice nearly stomped over there and did just that, but the truth was, Alice was still scared. She wanted to walk back into a crowd of Theronwood folk, knowing she was one of them. It was bad enough she'd been born with hardly any color. That her skin was the color of snow and her hair the color of sugar and her eyelashes the color of milk. She never liked to admit it, but the truth was true enough. By Theronwood standards, she really was the ugliest. Her world thrived on color, and she had none. But a task did not care about color. It did not depend on anything but magical talent, and talent was something Alice thought she had. Theronwood hearts were born with it. She, Alice Alexis Queensmeadow, had been born with a Theronwood heart, and her talent needed a task. She could not walk into that crowd without it. Alice didn't want to look at Oliver as he headed her way. She didn't care for his pompousness, and she certainly didn't want to hear him tell her how terrible her talent was. She didn't know what Oliver had surrendered, but Alice felt certain it was something stupid. Oliver cleared his throat. She noticed he'd slung a well-worn bag across his body. He must have been on his way somewhere, and Alice hoped that meant he'd finally leave her alone. "Hello, Oliver,"
Alice said curtly, plucking the envelope from his outstretched hand.
Alice?
He nodded.
You may go now.
She narrowed her eyes at him. Oliver crossed his arms and leaned against the tree trunk.
Open it,
he said.
I do not wish to open it in front of you,
she sniffed. He rolled his eyes. Don't be so stiff. Just because he won't be getting the best task doesn't mean—
And how do you know I won't?
Alice snapped, petulant in an instant.
There's no saying I can't still—
Because Kate Zuhair already did, he said with a sigh. Really, Alice, calm yourself. No one is judging you.
Oh,
she said, blinking fast. It was a small consolation, but Alice was relieved to hear that at least Danielle Rubin hadn't been the one to best her. Still, her pride would not let her be calm, certainly not in front of Oliver. I got a 3, you know. Alice looked up.
You got a 3?
Oliver nodded. And it's still the hardest thing I've ever had to do. I'm not sure you'd want a 5, even if you'd earned it. Alice swallowed hard. She'd never admit this to anyone, but after that performance, she was actually hoping for a 2, anything but a 1. 1 would be humiliating. Go on, then. Oliver tapped the envelope in her hand. All will be right as rain light as soon as you open it.
All right,
she whispered, wondering all the while why Oliver was being so nice to her. Probably he was still hoping she'd ditch her task in order to help him with his, which would never happen. Her hands shook as she broke the seal on the envelope, and it was there, as fate would have it. Right there, in front of Oliver Newbanks, the boy who'd crowned her the ugliest girl in all of Ferenwood, that Alice was faced with the worst reality of all. In her envelope was no card she'd ever seen before. It wasn't yellow or even white. It was black. A simple rectangle cut from thick, heavy paper. Oliver gasped. Alice flipped it over. Score. 0. The clouds chose that exact moment to come to life. The sky broke open and rain fell so hard and fast it nearly hurt, showering them all in what were supposed to be tears of happiness. Alice felt the cold, and she felt the wet, and she felt her bones breaking inside of her, and finally she lost the strength to be brave and gained instead the heart of a coward. So she ran away. She ran until her chest cracked, until her lungs burned, until she stumbled and tore her skirts and the tears could no longer be held. She couldn't tell who was crying harder, herself or the sky. By the time Oliver found her, Alice was nearly at the edge of Ferenwood, right on the border of Fennelskine, hiding under a penny bush. Alice hiccuped a sob and the pennies shook, silver chimes mocking her pain. She sniffled and choked back the last of her tears and turned her face to the clouds. The rain had stopped, and the sun was bright in the sky, and hundreds of rainbows had arched over everything, lending an ethereal glow to the world. Alice found the beauty unexpectedly cruel. She did not know what happened to children who were not tasked. There had only been 3 children to fail their surrender in all the hundreds of years it had gone on, and Alice had assumed they simply evaporated back into the ground. Returning to Ferenwood life certainly seemed impossible. Maybe she would follow in the footsteps of Father and just disappear.
Go away, Oliver,
Alice said quietly. She didn't want to be mean to him, as he'd done nothing in the last hour to deserve it, but she also wanted to be left alone. He crouched down beside her.
Come out from under there, Alice. I can see right up your skirts.
Go away,
she said again, making no effort to cross her ankles. Neither one of them spoke for a little while.
You really were splendid today,
Oliver finally said.
Yes, very.
Oh, come off it, Alice. I mean it.
If you'll please excuse me,
she said stiffly,
I have a great many things to do.
Oliver grabbed her ankles and tugged so hard Alice nearly fell into the brook nearby.
She had just gotten her mouth full of terrible things to say to him when he plucked the envelope out of her clenched fist and held her black card up to the sky. "You're supposed to unlock it, you know,"